Gee, your station has a lot of problems.
Tell me about it. Just look at our morning guy.
Hello, this is Mole Man in the Morning. Good Mole Man to you. Today, part four of our series of the agonizing pain in which I live every day.
You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, not the home of Mole Man in the Morning.
Columbia's local radio station. My name is Laura Fedorik, and my guest today is Dr. Sarah Birch. Dr. Birch is a Banting Postdoctoral Research Fellow at the University of British Columbia's Center for Interactive Research on Sustainability, and soon to be Assistant Professor of Climate and Society at the University of Waterloo. Sarah's work focuses on urban climate change governance, with an emphasis on practical, integrated approaches to sustainability. In May, she will be teaching a massive open online course on climate literacy. Sarah, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Laura.
Sarah, maybe you could start with telling us a little bit about what you're working on right now.
Sure, absolutely. So I have a couple of projects on the go at the moment as part of my Banting Postdoctoral Fellow. One is called Meeting the Climate Change Challenge, and that's a collaboration between Royal Roads University and Simon Fraser University, trying to look at the drivers of innovation on climate change in communities across the province. You know, we're in a very interesting context here. We have a revenue-neutral carbon tax. We have the Climate Action Charter, all of these sort of leading pieces of legislation put into place by the province. And we're curious how communities are responding to that legislation and if they're taking steps that are really transformative. So that's on the go at the moment. As you mentioned, I'm also preparing a massive open online course on climate literacy in collaboration with my colleague, Dr. Sarah Harris. And so we're preparing that course right now, and that'll launch mid-May on Coursera. So this is a whole new territory and a new level of engagement with thousands and thousands of students around the world. So that's pretty exciting stuff as well.
So that massive open online course, also known as a MOOC, is going to be on the topic of climate literacy. Could you tell us a little bit about the course?
Absolutely. So what we're trying to do with this course is really provide students around the world with the tools they need to kind of cut through all of the politicized, kind of polarized conversations about climate change and have at their disposal an understanding of kind of the core scientific tools like understanding radiative forcing and what greenhouse gases actually do and the energy balance of the planet. So just kind of those core bits before moving on to a deeper exploration of solutions. So, you know, how do we adapt to climate change? How do we reduce greenhouse gas emissions and what's really going on already on the ground in communities? So the approach is to synthesize the science with the policy, the human dimensions, so that people get a really good integrated picture of what we know, what we don't know, and what actions we can take on climate change.
And who do you think should be taking this course? Or who do you hope is going to be taking this course?
Right. Well, first off, the audience is of a scale that I've never experienced before. And those who teach in general in a face-to-face format, you know, are experienced with teaching 50, 100, 200 students at a time. This is on the order of thousands at a time. So it's a much more varied audience than I ever have experienced in the past. That said, I expect, in part because MOOCs, massive open online courses, are slightly new territory, some of the folks who take them tend to be kind of tech savvy, you know, engaged in the web in one way or another through social media. So that might be a slightly younger demographic, 20s, 30s, etc. But this course targets a different demographic than some other MOOCs in that it's focused on an issue that's really relevant today. It's kind of politically contentious. So in the past, this type of course has attracted professionals who are looking to maybe make a little shift in their career, take on more responsibility in terms of sustainability or climate change, those who are getting back into the workforce and see this as an area they can really contribute to, and then others just, you know, who may have an undergrad degree, may have a master's degree, may have neither, but feel that this is an issue that's important to them and they just want to know more so that they can kind of participate in the debate a little bit better.
How do you feel that MOOCs will change education?
That's a big question, and I think I don't think anyone has a really clear answer to that yet, which makes this both exciting and a little unnerving. I think MOOCs do a couple of things. They, in most cases, are free, so they offer free education to people anywhere. They're asynchronous, meaning you can take them at any time. So time zones aren't a problem. You can just log on and see the material, engage with the material on your own schedule. So that kind of cracks open the shell of universities in some ways and allows access to that education to people who couldn't afford traditional university education, people who are geographically remote or isolated and couldn't access it for that reason, or people who don't want to take a whole degree, don't want to engage at that level or can't because of time constraints or whatever. So they can taste test and learn little bits of what they'd like. So it opens universities up in a way that I don't think they ever have been in the past. I also think one of the most intuitive ways MOOCs will change education in universities in the very near term is what people call flipping the classroom. So, for instance, I would use the lectures I've prepared for my MOOC that are filmed and online. I would send my face-to-face tuition-paying students to go and watch those lectures, get the content, get the ideas, but then come back to me in the classroom, and we can spend all of that time in group work, in debate, in hands-on community engagement projects. So I think they will facilitate better use of face-to-face time and a pedagogical approach that's more engaging, more challenging, and more focused on really building those interactive skills that are so necessary for the workplace.
In particular, with regards to sustainability, how do you feel that MOOCs or open learning situations and sustainability complement each other?
I think in two ways. One is that, you know, sustainability is such a broad concept. It requires level of comfort, I think, with a really wide variety of disciplines, sciences and social sciences. So MOOCs offer students or just citizens, people, the opportunity to learn about the various aspects of sustainability that they might not be able to access information about typically. So it's a really great way of providing information. But even more importantly, I think I view sustainability as a conversation. It's very values-based, you know. What kind of risks are we willing to endure? How early should we act on the basis of how much or how little information? These are all societal questions. They're things we need to have conversations about. And I see MOOCs as a really interesting avenue to sparking that conversation, to harnessing, you know, the Web 2.0 phenomenon, crowdsourcing, Wikipedia-esque, you know, collaboration and participation, to have that conversation about what sustainability is and what it means in your own community.
Is that your hope for this course in particular?
I hope so. I'm honestly most excited about all of these students collaborating with each other. I certainly wouldn't profess to have all or even most at all of the answers. So while I'm providing some resources and doing my best to share my expertise with these students, they all have experiences that are incredibly rich and incredibly valid. And so they're being put in a virtual room together and can share those experiences and educate one another. So I think that it holds fairly significant potential in that regard.
If there's anyone who's listening who wants to sign up for this course, how would they do that?
They would go to www.coursera.org and search for climate literacy, and they would find the course very easily. It's just a couple of clicks and entering your email address and you're signed up.
Excellent. So back to the framing and the idea of the conversations that are going on around sustainability. What conversations do you think we should be having as university institutions and as engaged citizens in the arena of climate and sustainability?
Well, I think the broader societal conversation, to start with that, I guess, and then maybe move on from there to what the university can contribute. I do think that environmental issues and sustainability has sort of grown out of that have really been framed through a sort of natural or physical sciences lens, getting better models, shrinking our error bars, getting better statistics. Those are important dimensions. It's crucial to understand how the natural systems work and how ecosystems function and how we're affecting them. But ultimately, I view sustainability as a social question, as a question about equity and what sort of future we want for our children, whether we can deliver on environmental priorities and economic ones and social ones simultaneously. And I think that the values underpinning of sustainability is sort of treacherous territory, and I understand politically why we've avoided it in some ways. The conversation about vegetarianism, for instance, or driving your car, or all of those things that are so deeply bound up in our culture, I understand why it's a challenging conversation. But I think we need to take a hard look at the sort of cultural underpinnings of environmental problems and sustainability challenges. With regard to the university, you know, of course, I work in a university and I've contributed a lot of my working life to them. So I'm slightly biased in this way, but I feel that universities have this incredible opportunity. They're so well placed to contribute in more ways than they have in the past to the sustainability question. And I think UBC is a really great example of how that's happening. I mean, there's things going on here that in my opinion aren't going on anywhere else, and that is the university viewing itself not just as a place where students are taught and then they go out into the world, but also where the research of the faculty is really brought together with that teaching, and then the functioning of the university, all of the buildings that we're sitting in right now and the thousands and thousands of people who come and go from this campus, what we eat and how we move around here. All of that can be brought to bear directly on the question of innovating on sustainability and tinkering with our building systems, our energy systems, our materials use, so that we can be an example of what a sustainable community might look like. So that becomes a much more active role than just sharing information or this kind of unidirectional engagement with the community at large, which has been a more traditional role for the university.
And it sounds more inclusive as well.
Absolutely. I think there's a stronger role for residents here on campus to enact sustainability in their daily lives, for students and for faculty to engage with community beyond the campus and make a change in the city of Vancouver, in the region, in the world, through their research and through their day-to-day lives. So I think universities can both model sustainability themselves as well as investigate what others are doing and how paths are shifting.
How important is it for the public to understand the science of sustainability?
Well, I think there's a couple of ways you can answer this question. I think it's impossible for any of us to understand the full breadth and depth of scientific issues that are at play in a conversation about sustainability. You know, they run the gamut from atmospheric physics to terrestrial ecology to just anything you can imagine. It's such a diverse range of issues. So there are experts in every single one of those fields and more. I think it's empowering in some ways to grasp the scientific underpinnings of issues as we form opinions about them and decide what policies we support or don't support to respond to them. With that being said, though, you know, there's a whole ton of research that suggests that we're motivated by and we make decisions and change our behaviors on the basis of factors other than this kind of rational assessment of costs and benefits and an understanding of the technical underpinnings of problems. You know, if I need a surgery, if I need my car fixed, I trust somebody else to understand the workings of an internal combustion engine. I don't understand how that works. So I put my trust in those who I think do have that expertise. So I think that both the scientific underpinnings of sustainability are important, but the values conversation, the political and economic dimensions, are debates that we desperately need to have. And the importance of those factors in determining our behavior, I think, is much more significant than we ever previously thought.
How do those values come into play when we are making decisions?
I guess there's a couple of ways to think about that. One good example, just to kind of make it practical, is whether or not we choose to drive a car. You know, there are a couple of very rational reasons or underpinnings for making that decision. We cost out how much it costs to buy a car and pay for insurance and pay for gas and that sort of thing. But layered on top of that are a whole lot of other intangibles, like the status associated with driving a car, the comfort we feel, the convenience associated with driving a car instead of walking or taking public transit. There's also how we feel we should live. So that's a normative dimension. Do we feel pressure to, use public transit or walk instead of driving a car? Some scholars have talked about the emotional dimensions of decision making, the kind of very quick, instantaneous emotional feeling we get, the intuition about how to act, really interweaving in a complex way with rationality, with those kind of more clear assessments of the costs and benefits. So it's a complicated picture, but we are driven as much or more by our emotions, by social pressure, by status, by values, than we are by these more practical or what we might call rational dimensions.
You have a history of interdisciplinary research and particularly an action focus on environmental issues. Where does that come from?
So I think it comes in part from the same kind of natural inclination that I feel. When I started out in my undergrad degree at the University of Calgary, I first started in a Bachelor of Science degree in environmental science because I was deeply concerned and drawn to environmental issues. But despite the fact that there was a stream in that degree that allowed me to weave a little bit more social science and human geography into the program, I still felt that the focus on ecology, you know, terrestrial and aquatic ecosystems and organic chemistry and such, that helped me to understand the roots of the problem. But I was still left wondering why people didn't act to solve that problem. What were the politics of the issue? How did the economics pan out in terms of which policy should be taken or which action should be taken? So I felt this kind of urge to add all of that texture and that context, the human dimensions. And so I added on an arts degree in international relations. So to me, it took taking two degrees at the same time to answer enough of my questions to feel like I was grasping the issue. And I've aligned myself and been fortunate enough to find mentors and colleagues who completely understand the desire to blend practice with scholarship. And there's no question about whether or not my work should be community-oriented and action-oriented. So I've been very fortunate to be able to do both for the last almost 10 years, I guess. Consulting and working with companies, working with communities, and also pursuing the scholarship side.
Did that experience really drive you to think about this conversation and that weaving together in a new way? And was that where your desire to communicate some of these issues on an interdisciplinary context came from?
I certainly am inclined towards systems thinking in general. I want more nuance to the picture rather than less. I want to rule in explanations instead of rule them out. And that can yield a pretty complex picture that's uncertain and certainly, you know, there isn't a clear answer. But that to me is the way the world works. So the closer we can get to describing that and functioning well within it, you know, the better off we'll be.
How do you even start to describe that and kind of frame it in a context that is relatable and understandable so that people can start engaging with those complex issues?
Yeah. Well, it's a good question because certainly with problems like climate change and sustainability, you run the risk of getting so vague and so complex that people feel disempowered and apathetic or sort of overwhelmed. So I think that there are a couple ways that help me for to navigate that. And one is actually a theoretical body of literature, interestingly, but systems theory and complex adaptive systems to me suggests, you know, different systems are interwoven, different areas of our lives, different aspects of the planetary system are interconnected. And actions in one can have unintended consequences in another, and new things can emerge spontaneously out of those systems that we didn't expect. And so understanding flows, stocks, flows, feedbacks, thresholds, kind of thinking through a systems lens, to me really helps kind of reveal the logic of the way society works, instead of hiving off little bits and tinkering in them and making all of these assumptions about the rest and then coming up with the result that isn't really relevant. The other way I find is that's really helpful is anchoring it all in local spaces, which again connects to my, I guess, inclination to have this work be action-oriented. And I'm really finding in the case of climate change, you know, there's heaps of global science and global negotiations and international conversations about climate change. But ultimately, how we respond to the problem actually happens at the local level. Whether we're, you know, negotiating these greenhouse gas reduction targets through the Kyoto Protocol process and other international negotiations, that's all well and good. But ultimately, getting to those targets means we have to put things in place in our neighborhoods and our communities. So we do a lot of work, for instance, in the Collaborative for Advanced Landscape Planning, led by Professor Stephen Shepherd and others. We do work to actually create visualizations of the future. So 3D computer-generated images that look almost like video games that show real neighborhoods down at the street level, show how they change over time, you know, scrolling through 2020, 2050, 2100 under different assumptions, to bring community members together, talk to counselors, mayors, planners, engineers, practitioners, get them all in a room and walk them through what climate change and sustainability might actually look like in their community, so that they can feel it viscerally, see it in iconic spaces that resonate with them, and choose their pathway from there instead of from this extremely abstract world of numbers and graphs and error bars.
What are the reactions that you get of the public who comes in to engage with those processes?
Oh, there's been a whole gamut, really. But I think, in general, people are more able to process a complex picture. They can, from a visual image, you can instantly internalize intuitively such complex information that, you know, if you drilled it all down into graphs and numbers and sort of more traditional scientific communication methods, it would be almost impossible to internalize all of that data. But visual imagery does it in an instant. It's incredible. So people are kind of able to walk through these worlds in this very agile way that I don't think they could if we used other methods. They also really internalize the risks associated with climate change. So if you show flooding in their neighborhood, you know, coming up against their doorsteps, and talk to them about the frequency and the severity and what response options are available, they really grasp that risk much better than in the abstract, certainly. And I also think they're able to think about, you know, this comes back to our discussion of what sustainability is. It's many things. It's not just one ecosystem. It's not just the environment. It's human systems as well. And when you create these images and these scenarios, people weave it all together in their mind, and they think about the aesthetic quality of their communities. They think about the livability and how far they have to get, you know, how far they have to walk to work, and what their homes look like, and what they're eating. And all of these things can be woven together in an image in a way that it can't, I don't think, as easily in other formats.
You talked a little bit about the international protocols, and you actually engaged and were a contributing author to the fourth assessment report of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, both in the Working Group for Impacts, Adaptation, and Vulnerability, as well as the Working Group for Mitigation of Climate Change. How do you feel the conversation has changed since the release of that report?
Well, it's an interesting time to talk about that because, of course, the next report is near completion. So we'll see the fifth assessment report of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change come out quite soon. How has the conversation changed? Well, the conversation became about all of these things that I think take us down the wrong path on sustainability and climate change. It came down to certainty in models and the robustness of our statistics. And while that's really valuable, I think defining climate change as a purely scientific problem starts us out from the wrong place. So it's been a rocky couple of years, I think, for our conversation about climate change. And I think there's an appetite for shifting it somewhat away from that purely biophysical sort of science-driven notion to one that's a little bit more nuanced on the social side.
What does that tell us about the process of these conversations and what maybe has been learned in terms of how we go about engaging and how we bring in different groups to kind of come up with this information?
Yeah, well, the process of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change is like no other process, and I think it certainly deserves, I mean, it deserves its place in history, really, and the future, for that matter. It's, you know, one of the largest scientific collaborations of its kind. It's exceedingly rigorously peer-reviewed and vetted, and it gets a larger number of scientific voices at the table than anything else I've seen. So it's incredible in that way. But then there's the process of political negotiations of, you know, the Kyoto Protocol process, the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. And that process is changing as well to be more inclusive, I think, of non-state actors, of non-governmental organizations, more civil society groups really participating in those discussions instead of it simply being between heads of state or governments, national governments at the international level. So I think there's a shift. I think there's a fairly pervasive sense of disappointment about the results that we've seen from the Kyoto Protocol. So, you know, while the European Union is on track to meet its Kyoto Protocol targets, Canada has formally withdrawn. We were the first nation to formally withdraw from Kyoto, and global emissions continue to go up. So not such great results from those global negotiations, despite them planting the seeds for incredible action in a lot of ways around the world and really putting this on the agenda. So we shouldn't discount that. But I think there's an increasing push towards having this conversation at the sub-national level, in provinces, in states, in communities, for all of the reasons we've discussed about climate change and sustainability needing to be anchored in local spaces and really being about community values and what we want our cities, our communities to look like in 50 or 100 years. So I think there's a shift from the global to the local in terms of the conversation about climate change. And I see that as very promising. You know, it might have started out as filling the vacuum left by an absence of leadership at the federal level or stalled negotiations globally. But I think now it's really cause for optimism.
And shifting back to open online courses, how does one integrate that local feel?
Well, it's hard because my students are from everywhere and I don't know their experience in a lot of ways. And despite my well-intentioned efforts otherwise, I was born and raised in Canada. So I have a developed country, Western lens on a lot of the work I do. So I think in this MOOC, there's the opportunity to bring to the surface voices that aren't typically heard from communities around the world that are often silenced because of lack of financial means or these kinds of issues. So I think it holds great potential there. One really cool way, I hope, that we're trying to bring a more community lens is that two of our assignments are asking students to go into their own communities, take out their smartphones or their cameras and take photos, take little videos of what they see to be climate change either occurring or may